From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now, and as a handful of states move towards reopening, Nebraska, Ohio, and North Dakota are seeing cases rise. And the head of the CDC tells the Washington Post a second wave next winter could be worse than the wave passing through much of the country right now.
Well, in and around Washington, D.C., there are now more than 26,000 confirmed cases. That includes Maryland and Virginia. It's become a hotspot with more than 1,000 confirmed deaths. Martin Ostermuhl is a reporter at WAMU in Washington. And Martin, can you lay out for us what's going on there with the pandemic in the D.C. region, what experts estimate the peak to be, and how hospitals are doing?
Well, it's kind of all over the place when it comes to the peak. I mean, you have the district, you have Maryland and Virginia, and all three states have kind of adopted their own models that tell them when they think their peak case count is going to be and how the hospitals are going to fare. But at this point across the region, it could be anywhere from mid-May to as late as July. That's where the district is. They're saying late into the summer this could be going on. But there are glimmers of hope, though. Over the last week, leaders in the region have said that they have seen some signs that the curve is flattening. So they are starting to see that they may be coming in a little sooner than they expected. Now, in terms of hospitalization data, all the governments around here say they have enough hospital beds to handle demand, but they have been beefing up. Both the district and Maryland are using convention centers as field hospitals, just in case the worst of what could happen does happen.
Okay, so we also know that Governor Larry Hogan purchased 500,000 tests from South Korea. That was a super controversial thing because the president claimed that Maryland had enough tests. What do we know about testing there?
Well, so like a lot of places across the country, testing capacity has been very limited. So Governor Hogan essentially did what he could. He went to South Korea. He got 500,000 tests from them. Now, to put it into context, Maryland has only tested 70,000 people to date. So 500,000 is a huge increase for them.
That's Martin Ostermuhl. He's a reporter at WAMU in Washington. Thanks for this update.
Thanks for having me.
Well, it is not just doctors and nurses on the front lines of this pandemic. It's also paramedics who have to ambulance the sick to hospitals. Let's check in now with one of them, David Goroff, a paramedic in Lower Merion, Pennsylvania, outside of Philadelphia. Welcome.
Thank you.
Well, and you've been responding to several coronavirus-related 911 calls a day. We understand there are a lot of nursing homes in your area. Can you describe what some of those calls have been like?
Sure. We're as a department, we're going on anywhere between 5 to 15 of these kind of calls a day. And as you said, we have a lot of nursing facilities in our area, and a lot of those calls are happening at these nursing facilities. I went to a nursing home 4 days ago. There were three patients in the room, definitely within 6 feet. And I was there for one of the patients who had a new onset of fever, cough, shortness of breath, all very consistent with the coronavirus. And you're looking in that room and thinking, I'm going to be back here in the next week for all of the roommates. And it's a very scary thought.
And when you go into a situation like that, do you have the personal protective equipment that you need?
My department has been very lucky. Our supply chain has, though, been very interrupted, just like the rest of the country. We've been doing a really great job at kind of tracking down those last pieces of PPE that are out there floating and procuring them. We're wearing Tyvek suits, N95 or P100 masks, gloves, and goggles on all of these calls.
You've had several colleagues test positive for COVID-19 and have to quarantine for 2 weeks before returning to work. Some are sleeping in hotels to avoid infecting their families. Give us a sense of the toll that this pandemic is taking on you and your team, both physically and emotionally.
Physically, the toll is manageable. We have had, at our peak, we had 12 staff members out, 5 full-time staff members. And that takes a toll on our ability to staff and to respond to 911 calls on a day-to-day basis, but it's manageable. The psychiatric toll on the staff is something that I think about a lot and I'm very worried about for the staff and also for me. Stress has always been a part of this job, but this stress feels very different because it's ongoing. I've had, extremely stressful incidents over the course of my career. I worked on a 16-year-old in cardiac arrest, pronounced him dead, and then had to walk up from his room and tell his parents that he had died, which obviously is a stressful thing. And you ask any paramedic in the country, and they've had that kind of terrible experience. But that experience happens, hopefully, once. And you go home, you deal with it, you talk to your colleagues, you talk to your family, and you hopefully are able to move on. This stress is ongoing. We've been kind of in the midst of this now for more than a month, and every single day they know they're going to treat one of these patients, and they're going to have to do it again and again and again, and they're risking bringing this back to their family. And that stress is continuous, and we don't see kind of an end in sight.
One of the things that I've heard is that people who call into 911 may not be telling the 911 operator everything that is actually true because they're afraid about answering questions honestly when it comes to COVID-19. Have you experienced that?
I have. Unfortunately, I had an incident where parents had called for their son who was injured. The 911 operator asked them all the COVID-19 screening questions. The police asked them when they showed up. I asked them. And when we got to the hospital, they very sheepishly looked at me and told me that they had not been truthful and they had close contact with someone who had been tested positive for the coronavirus. And when I asked them why they had not been forthcoming, they told me that they were worried that we wouldn't take care of them and we wouldn't take them to hospital. I would just say that help is going to come either way, and people shouldn't be afraid to be honest with first responders, with the 911 dispatchers and operators, because help will come either way. It's just we're going to take kind of elevated precautions if we are trying to avoid us being infected by a patient.
You say that it's hard to see the end in sight. At this point, do you feel like the peak is past where you are anyway and that things are getting better?
I'm sitting here looking at a graph of our numbers right now. Today's numbers are bringing me a little bit of optimism. We had our lowest growth in new cases in our area. But in terms of our 911 calls for patients that are reporting symptoms consistent with coronavirus, that number has remained relatively steady.
That is David Goroff, who's a paramedic in Lower Merion, Pennsylvania. David, thanks for talking with us, and thanks for the work that you're doing right now.
Thank you. It's a pleasure talking with you.
Well, because of collapsing demand during the pandemic, the world is awash in crude oil. But producers keep pumping oil, so people are running out of places to put it. NPR's Jackie Northam reports.
The math is simple. Every day, about 100 million barrels of crude are pumped out of the ground to fuel our cars, planes, and factories. The coronavirus outbreak has derailed those activities, but producers are still pumping. Now, there's an oversupply of crude not seen before.
You actually might see a situation now where the world might run out of storage space, and for crude oil, that is. And that is unprecedented. I'm not saying it's going to happen, but it's definitely a scenario that's no longer crazy.
Eric Brukhausen is an analyst with Poten & Partners, a New York-based ship broker and oil consultant. He says oil producers and traders are hustling to find places to stash crude. The first choice is storage terminals, like the one in Cushing, Oklahoma.
Storage tanks, the ones that will fill up the quickest and first are the cheapest.
Brukhausen says some countries, like China, are filling up their strategic petroleum reserves with low-cost crude. President Trump says he wants to buy oil from hard-hit U.S. producers and store that. But Congress isn't releasing money for that. After storage tanks and reserves, it comes down to oil tankers, says Lois Zabrocki, CEO of International Seaways, one of the largest tanker companies in the world.
All of a sudden, there's a very intense demand for our tankers, and it starts on the very large crude carriers or the 2 million, the vessels that can store and move 2 million barrels a day.
Zabrocki says so far there are more than 75 of these super large tankers out on the water, waiting, bobbing around, loaded to the gills with crude.
So if it's the Saudis, they may have you hang out in Fujairah, right? But they have some storage in the Red Sea. They have storage in Japan. So other ships will go and sit off of Singapore. The U.S. Gulf would be a place where ships would sit.
But it isn't a cheap way to store oil. A year ago, the large ships would charge about $25,000 to $30,000 a day. Now, it's anywhere from $80,000 to $150,000 a day, says Christian Weatherby, a shipping analyst at Citi Research.
They are trying to lock in as much of this revenue because they know that it's not a long-term scenario. And they're trying to make as much money as they can while they can. And frankly, I think they're doing a pretty good job of it.
Weatherby says there are about 800 super large tankers at sea. So unlike land, you won't run out of space to store crude.
Listen, if you're willing to pay $100,000 or $150,000 a day for one of these ships, you'll get as many ships as you want.
Jackie Northam, NPR News.
So what is all this oil on the market doing to gas prices? Well, so far, the national average has dropped to $1.80. The cheapest gas on average in the U.S. is in the state of Wisconsin, $1.19 on average. The most expensive? Of course, it is Hawaii, $3.16 on average. But no matter where you are, the problem with cheap gas is, where are you supposed to go?
This message comes from Here and Now sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. That's why you need Indeed.com. Post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates using an intuitive online dashboard. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free at Indeed.com/here now. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply. Offer valid through March 31st, 2020.
Weeks ago, doctors at the Elmhurst Hospital in Queens, New York, described the scene there as apocalyptic. The neighborhoods around the hospital, Corona, Elmhurst, Jackson Heights, have been some of the hardest hit in New York City. Pressure on the hospital is easing now as the city manages to flatten the curve, but the community is still facing economic devastation. We're joined now by Catalina Cruz, who represents those parts of Queens and the New York State Assembly. Welcome. And Assemblywoman, you've been passing out food to your constituents. Give us a sense of what's happening in your community.
So I think one of the things that's very important is to understand the context of the type of community that I serve. We were already living on the fringes of poverty. The folks who live here, 60% are born in another country, 40% have a non-citizenship status or no status at all, meaning many of them are undocumented and don't qualify for federal, state, or city bailouts. Very, very few choices of where to get help. And so we find ourselves having to be the front line for hunger, for resources, because when folks don't work, they don't eat, they can't pay rent, and they start making these very, very long lines at food pantries to get help. So one of the first things I did is I turned my actual district office into a food pantry where we give out meals, daily meals, to whoever is willing to come over, make the line. And we even deliver to seniors who may be homebound and have an emergency while we set them up with a more permanent resource for food. And what I am seeing is a line that started with 300 people and now has grown to 2,000 meals. I've seen people who happen to have worked at local restaurants. I see folks from construction unions. I see day laborers. One of the very interesting things is that generally you would see mothers and seniors in these lines. And now you're seeing men, heads of household. You're seeing single people coming to these food lines because they have no other choice.
Yeah. You know, I can just tell from your voice that you are in action mode, but this has to be very heartening to see not only the support from your community, but also to see the need. I mean, this is astounding. Thousands of people waiting in line.
I got to tell you, it's a little bit of a mix of feelings, because on the one hand, my heart is full with the number of neighbors who are reaching out to us saying, how can I help? Where do I send donations? How can I help make deliveries? You know, starting this Thursday, we're going to give out baby products because so many mothers were asking us for diapers and milk because they were running out. And when we put out the call, now my basement is full of boxes of diapers. So on that one hand, I am so happy to see the love of our community for each other. But on the other hand, I am very disappointed in our federal government. These are folks that, regardless of their immigration status, have contributed billions, with a B, of dollars into our state and federal economy. And when they needed us, we turned our backs on them and said, not our problem. And that's not fair.
For folks who don't know a little bit about you, you're the first former Dreamer in the New York State Assembly. You were once undocumented. This is a population that you not only know because you serve on behalf of them, but you were and you are part of this community as well. I hear your frustration about the federal response. What are your thoughts also about the state response?
I'm very thankful to Governor Cuomo because he has implemented certain policies that have helped, as we can see, the numbers flatten the curve, give us certain resources that we need. But, you know, in the same way that I am thankful for that, I'm very wary of the fact that during our state budget, we failed to raise the taxes on the uber rich in our state so that we could have the money to meet certain needs. So I am going to continue to push him to meet those needs. Right now, we don't have a unemployment insurance system that actually allows undocumented workers. And I say workers because these are people who have worked and contributed to our state taxes, but when they lose their job, they cannot claim anything. And so they're left at the mercy of the help that the charity organizations are helping out right now, and it should not be that way. And so I am hoping that as this continues to move, the governor will move in the right direction, because even though he's done a lot, it's not enough. We're going to find ourselves here in the fall, 2 years from now, 10 years from now, and we need to stop it.
Your community has lost some really incredible people, from pastors to activists. Can you tell us a little bit more about a few of the people who have passed away?
Two of my favorite humans who will forever be angels looking over our community. And one of them is Lorena Borjas, and I say is because her memory will forever live with us. She is, in essence, the godmother of the Translatina movement in our neighborhood. She dedicated her life to making sure that we saw our Translatina sisters, that we fought for them. And she created the kind of community that is loving, that is resilient, and we as allies are going to continue to fight for them and with them to honor that love that she had for them. And then there was, there will forever be, Father Antonio Checo, who was one of the pillars of our community. He actually delivered a prayer during my inauguration and reminded me that the service I was about to undertake had to be in the name of the community and taking into account that this wasn't about me, this was about the needs of people. And that's how he lived his life as a former social worker, as, you know, the religious counselor to so many of the people in our community. That's how he lived, remembering that this service isn't about him, it's about the people who need it. And from the moment I heard that he had passed, I've been trying to live the service that I do that way, not thinking about what I need, but how do I meet the needs of my people?
Assemblywoman, I'm so sorry for your loss. Yeah, I'm sorry for your loss, and it's a loss for all of us.
He will forever be remembered and honored because he was an amazing human.
Assemblywoman Catalina Cruz, who represents part of Queens in the New York State Assembly, thank you so much for your work, and thank you so much for sharing with us what's happening in your community.
Thank you.
Testing is a big factor right now in the fight to stop the spread of COVID-19. And this week, the Food and Drug Administration approved the first at-home test for the coronavirus. It will allow patients to collect nasal swab samples and mail them in for results. But there are questions about the speed and accuracy of these tests. Aaron Broadwin has been covering this for our partners at STAT, the Health and Medicine publication. Hi, Aaron.
Hi.
So first of all, describe what this means. Really, when will this test be available and who has access to this?
Yeah, so on Tuesday, the FDA cleared the first at-home test for coronavirus, and it is initially being rolled out to healthcare workers and is expected to be available to patients at a timeline that is currently unclear, but the company has said several weeks.
Got it. So I talked a little bit about nasal swab samples, but how will this testing kit work?
Yeah, so that's a really good question, because in opposition to a couple of other tests that companies tried to make available previously, which use a longer type of nose swab that's pretty difficult to use, you have to essentially jam it all the way into the back of your nose or throat. This test is actually shallower and uses more of like a Q-tip type of nasal swab. You don't have to make yourself cry to use it.
I see. But with it being shallow, I guess that's also really brings to mind the accuracy of this test kit.
What we've seen so far is that in general, the tests are estimated to have a sensitivity of around 95%, which is really good. Yeah. However, that sensitivity is based on, you know, it can vary based on everything from when someone takes the test. So if they're really early in the virus or, on the other hand, really late in the virus, they'll have less of a viral load in places like their nose and mouth, which makes it a little bit harder to get an accurate test. If a patient, for example, is too early or too late and has less virus to test for, they might not catch it. So that patient would receive a negative test result when perhaps they actually do have coronavirus.
So where can folks get these tests from and where are they mailing them to?
LabCorp has said that it's going to make the test available directly to patients in several weeks. I would imagine that they would take the path that other companies have taken in this space, which is allowing folks to order them online once they have an order from a physician. And then they would be mailed to their homes directly. Then they would take the test, package it up, and then mail it to LabCorp for processing.
So this news comes just weeks after this back and forth that we saw between the FDA and startups who sought to develop their own versions of this test. What has changed since then?
It has definitely been a little bit of a roller coaster. Starting in March, I talked to three startups that thought that they had at-home COVID-19 tests that were in the clear. But shortly after those tests came out, FDA came out with a very stern warning, essentially, that said, we have not approved a single at-home test for coronavirus. And all three of the companies that I talked to immediately stopped selling their tests directly to consumers. But one of the issues, I believe, with those tests was the fact that they were using deeper, longer nasal swabs, those same tricky swabs that we talked about that are tough to get an accurate sample with. And so now that these easier to use Q-tip type swabs are available, my understanding is that this test will be a little bit easier.
That's health tech reporter Erin Broadwin with our partners at STAT, the Health and Medicine publication. Thank you so much, Erin.
Thanks for having me.
Today, Delta Airlines reported its first quarterly loss in 9 years. Just one more indication of how the coronavirus continues to disrupt the airline industry. In fact, according to FlightAware, the number of flights airlines are operating has dropped so drastically that Charlotte Douglas International Airport in North Carolina is now the fourth busiest in the world. For perspective, London's Heathrow doesn't even rank in the top 25 right now. Let's talk more about this with Here and Now transportation analyst Seth Kaplan. Hi, Seth.
Hi, Jeremy.
And just how many flights are operating these days, and why is Charlotte among the world's busiest airports?
At a lot of these U.S. airports, you might have, oh, about as many flights all week as you would usually have in one day. The difference is that around the world, you have places where there basically aren't any flights at all. So it's not that Charlotte is so busy. It's that other airports have lost almost everything, whereas U.S. airlines have cut a lot, kind of 70 to 90% maybe of their flights, but they're still somewhat flying. Part of that required by the government as a condition of getting the aid. They still have to serve almost all the same destinations they used to serve, even if they've cut flights, and they still have to keep everybody employed, at least their direct employees, through the end of September.
And for the flights that are happening, are there requirements for passengers and crew members to wear masks while on board?
Not in America. And that's different from Canada, for example, which is now requiring masks. So in America, you know, the same guidance that we have, which is that we should, and of course, there are localities where you have to do it in a supermarket and so forth, but nothing federal, kind of like everything in this country right now, kind of a patchwork, and nothing federal requiring masks on planes.
There's an upsetting story in the LA Times of more than a dozen airline employees who died from COVID-19. There could be many more that we don't know about. Are there any policies in place that U.S. airlines have to follow now to protect their employees?
Yeah, pretty remarkable, Jeremy. I went back and counted how many crew members died on 9/11, for example. There were 33 pilots and flight attendants, obviously many more passengers, not to mention the thousands of others. But so as you said, a dozen, and as you said, that there's no central repository of this. That's just what the LA Times counted.
Right.
And airlines are now telling their crew members to wear face masks, to practice social distancing. You know, they're cleaning their planes more deeply than before. The concern was that back at the beginning of this, not only was some of that not required, but employees say they weren't even allowed to do some of those things.
Well, and you also wonder about all the people who run the shops and restaurants in airports around the country, not to mention baggage handlers and support staff like that. Are you hearing anything about them getting sick?
Again, just sort of no central repository. It's all so diffuse that it's hard to say, but they are people who are exposed to it just like everybody else. Now, a lot of those stores and restaurants aren't open anymore, so there is less exposure because of that, as well as simply the fact that not as many people are traveling. Those airports are rather empty now.
All right, Seth. So the big question that we all have, and there really isn't an answer to yet, but I'll ask anyway, when are we going to be able to use the credit that we've got from canceled flights?
Yeah, I joked to a friend recently that if Forbes had a list of like the richest people in the world ranked not by wealth, but by useless airline vouchers, I would be one of the richest people in the world. At least the airlines do keep extending the validity in some cases as much as 2 years from now.
Here now, transportation analyst Seth Kaplan, thank you.
Thanks, Jeremy.
Millions of Americans are working from home now due to the coronavirus pandemic, a change that came about quickly without a lot of time to prepare or figure out the most effective way to do it. Well, let's bring in someone who was thinking about how best to work from home long before it was cool. Joining us now is Scott Mautz, who is a former Procter & Gamble executive and writes about business. Hi, Scott.
Great to be here again under strange circumstances this time.
Well, yeah, and we talked to you before about working from home way before everybody in the country started working from home. But now that so many of us are doing it, what are we getting wrong about it? What do you think would make it more efficient or better for us to all do as we work from home?
We all have the best intent in mind, and we think it's as simple as, okay, I'm working remote, so what that means is I just jump on the phone and I just carry on as normal. But dynamics, human dynamics are very different. You've got to replicate the basic human need for face-to-face contact. Research shows us that 55% of what we communicate comes from our body language, with only 7% coming from the words we speak. So even when we remember to do video calls, a lot of times you'll see that floating head, right? You've probably experienced it yourself. You're on a video call with someone and all you can see is from the neck up. In fact, you should probably move back just a little bit, so that the video feed doesn't frame just your face, it also frames your upper body so that people can get a sense for your body language. Use video more than you ever thought you'd have to do when working remotely.
Does that mean that you should use it just for the one-on-one calls that you're making instead of making a phone call for that? Because right now, you know, when I communicate with the whole staff, we're using Zoom, but when I'm calling one producer, I'll just call them on the phone.
Even in one-on-ones, the more video that you can do, the better. You know, another thing that we're not getting exactly right is that people are treating communication like an activity and not a strategy. Part of your strategy would be, okay, I want to maintain relationships. I want them to feel like I still care. I'm empathetic that nothing has changed that much from the office. And when it comes to communication in general, I have to be more frequent than I would have normally thought. I have to be even clearer than I would have ever thought that I would have to do. And I have to be even more honest because so much can be lost otherwise.
What if you're a manager and you've got a number of employees who used to be right in front of your face and you could keep track of what everybody's doing, and now you can't do that anymore? What's the most effective way to manage remotely?
It's to manage by objective and not necessarily by observation. Get clear on what my people need to deliver on those objectives and give them the freedom to get to those objectives the way that they see fit.
Now, I have to say that one of the things that I have heard from a lot of people who are working from home is that they feel that they're working harder than they ever did before. And part of that is because there's no barrier between work life and home life anymore. How do you make sure that you're giving yourself enough time to just not work while you're at home, since your office is in your house or in your apartment?
You've hit on one of the raging debates about, is there a downside to working remotely or not? Work life just not only became integrated, it became indiscernible. You have to be able to draw boundaries, not only with your boss, but with your family. Setting up your workstation in a place away from places where you relax, where you eat your food, where you do your exercise, treat it like an office. Even if it's a corner of your bedroom, and say, I am not returning to that desk after, I'm making it up, 6:30 p.m. After that, it's family time. Drawing physical, mental, and actual boundaries with all those around you is absolutely critical to do.
So, Scott, last time we talked to you about working from home, it was with the idea that maybe if more people worked from home, we wouldn't have the kind of traffic that we had, and maybe people would even be more productive than they are when they work in the office. Do you think that what's happening right now is going to lead to major changes about how work gets done in the future? Do you think that a lot of Americans will never end up going back to the office, even when they're allowed to do so?
It's an overused term, and I hesitate to use it, but we are going to be experiencing a new normal pretty soon. And the data is already indicating this. I've been connected up with a Gallup organization, a polling giant. They've been collecting an insane amount of data. And what we're seeing is leaders are not stepping up and delivering the things that history has shown us employees most need when working in times of crisis remotely. They need a clear plan of action, yet less than half of them are saying they're getting that from their boss. Less than half feel they're equipped to do their job. A little bit more than half feel like the communication is solid. Less than half think that there's a concern for total well-being. As Gallup is measuring this, that is still showing an incredible amount of improvement from week to week. So even though the numbers for all of those things are dismal, we're getting better at it. And I think people are starting to understand that you can have your cake and eat it too. That stories are popping up all around the country now of companies saying that for the first time they're going to consider a heavy remote workforce because they've seen the value of it. I think we have the data to show that we're improving our capabilities in working remotely, and the attitude is changing. So absolutely, I think there's no turning back now. You're going to see major changes moving forward.
I think another piece of this, by the way, is probably people are working harder than ever from home because they're so thankful to have a job right now when so many people have lost their jobs.
That's exactly right. You're talking about something scientists call the essentials effect. But, you couple up the basic appreciation that people have for something that was taken away from them or could have been taken away from them in times like this, having a job. You marry that up with employers who are thinking like, and now I see that job can be done remotely. That means less cut jobs in the future. I think the future is bright for remote work.
That is Scott Mautz, who is a former Procter & Gamble executive who writes about business. Scott, thank you so much for joining us.
Happy to be here.
And we'll share some of Scott's tips, and we'd love to hear yours about working from home at hereandnow.org, or send me a tweet at Jeremy Hobson. Well, even as Washington State's Governor Jay Inslee says he won't be able to lift many of the stay-at-home restrictions by May 4th, that was the day the current directive is set to expire, he does hope that health modeling in the coming days will allow the resumption of some activities such as elective surgeries. The continuation of restrictions rise from concerns that the virus is still spreading into more remote parts of Washington State. Producer Ashley Ahern lives in one of them and sent us this audio postcard.
I'm riding my horse up through the sagebrush out back where I keep her at a friend's place in the valley I live in, which is about 4 hours north and east of Seattle over the mountains. Town of about 600 people. Keeping your physical distance is not very hard, I gotta say. And life sort of feels eerie and quieter, and the town is empty. But spring is happening the same way it does every year. The ranchers are getting the irrigation system set up. Cows are getting ready to go out to their summer range. And yet there's this weird feeling that everything's falling apart around us in the cities. And I look on social media and my friends. My heart breaks for my good friends who live in cities and are confined to their small apartments right now. And I understand the need and the desire for so many folks in cities to go to, you know, rural places and escape to mountain towns. And I know, living in one of those towns, that there's real fear that, you know, more of the virus will come with those people. The nearest hospital for me is about 2 hours away, and they've got a couple, handful of ventilators, maybe. And, you know, at the bar, before they closed the bar, ranchers were making jokes about exploding, setting explosive on the pass, the main pass that brings, you know, leads to Seattle from here, to keep the city people from coming over if things got worse. And, you know, they were joking, but there's some real fear underneath that, and a sense that, you know, don't come here. We can't handle, we don't have the medical infrastructure to deal with it. But it also unearths some real divisions between country folk and city folk right now that have been there for a long time. And the virus maybe brings out the worst in that regard. But it's also bringing out the best. People are helping each other. You know, the donations are up for the local food bank, which has also seen a 20% increase in families coming in to get groceries every week. For me, every day, you know, I'm just looking at the landscape as it changes, and it's hard not to feel hope and energy. There's some peace in this forced pause that we're all living right now. Some solace in the fact that nature out here anyway continues like normal, as it always has every spring. Maybe things are a little quieter and it's a little easier to listen to it and observe it and slow down and take it all in this year. Even though there's kind of a sick feeling in my stomach, there's some peace out here to be had. And I wish I could share it with all my friends in the cities right now who are so worried and taking cover. For Here and Now, I'm Ashley Ahern in Winthrop, Washington.
A few weeks ago, we learned that Black people in the U.S. are contracting and dying from COVID-19 at disproportionately high rates. Dr. Anthony Fauci said there are a number of reasons for these outcomes: pre-existing conditions like diabetes, hypertension, obesity, and asthma.
So we're very concerned about that. It's very sad. It's nothing we can do about it right now except to try and give them the best possible care to avoid those complications.
But there are places throughout the country now trying to mitigate these disparities in real time. For more, we're joined by Akilah Johnson, narrative healthcare reporter at ProPublica. Welcome to Here and Now.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yeah, so Akilah, several states have now formed these task forces to look at the numbers and come up with some action steps to address these racial disparities. You were one of the first to report on the high number of Black people contracting and dying from this disease. And you focused on Milwaukee because they were the first to actually release racial data. What did you learn after looking at that data?
When we first started looking into Milwaukee, all of the deaths that they had were of African Americans. So at the time, I believe there were 10, and all 10 people who had died were Black. And then as the numbers continued to grow, the disparity continued. Not everybody who continued to die in Milwaukee was Black. So as the numbers grew, there was more diversity in death, shall we say, but a disproportionate number of the folks who ultimately lost their lives to this virus remained African Americans in Milwaukee. And it is a trend that is keeping pace, unfortunately, in a lot of major cities and states throughout the country. And
I want to ask you a little bit more about that data, because in many instances, though, I mean, Milwaukee had this clear data, but what we've been seeing so far, it seems to be incomplete and kind of patchwork depending on the state and the city. And actually looking at that CDC data, it said that race was unknown in 75% of the patients with COVID-19. But there's also this issue of what constitutes as Black or Latino, meaning Latino is an ethnicity. There are people who actually identify both as Black and white within that group. So how is race actually being tracked?
Right. And so that unknown also has to do with data somehow being lost in the reporting process between what's happening at intake to what's ultimately being reported to the CDC. Either the questions aren't being asked or they're, you know, being recorded on some forms. And I've heard that in some instances, yes, there is a fear in some communities in terms of even giving that type of information But then you also have brought up a really good point, right? And that is in terms of how do people identify, and with the Latinx community being, you know, an ethnicity and also crossing over and being able to cross over various kind of racial categories and what that means. And I think at the end of the day, it's just, from what I'm understanding, there was not a lot of intentionality. The message hadn't been kind of given out strong enough from the beginning that this is information that must be collected. These are questions that you have to ask, and this is a conversation that you have to engage in.
With that, now that the CDC is being more intentional in collecting that data, why is it important in the scope of now many municipalities and states taking the step of actually trying to mitigate it in real time?
Exactly. So I've had some conversations with some, you know, Representative Ayanna Pressley, Representative Robin Kelly, who have really been pushing and advocating from mid-March to have this data. And they're saying it's not data mining for the sake of data mining. It's data mining in order to save lives and then begin to direct resources at areas that are hot spots, or to begin to direct resources to areas that could be hot spots. And so that goes to comorbidities, and it comes to what are known as kind of heat maps. You know, there has been a lot of talk in the public health space about kind of understanding where some of these health disparities already exist. Let's now use the data to begin to target resources to these hardest hit communities. And so that's what we see in Milwaukee. That's part of the reason, you know, you could pick up on a Milwaukee. They were being transparent from the beginning, and they are continuing to have conversations that say, okay, how can we bring young people and get young people involved in this conversation?
And is that what some of the other places, like Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer announced this creation of a task force? Louisiana is also putting together a task force. And you mentioned some of the things that Milwaukee is doing. Ultimately, all of this is to be able to zero in and mitigate and stop the spread of this disease.
So, yes. And so it also goes to messaging and then testing center resources. And in Boston, for example, if you live in one of the communities that, and they typically are communities of color where you see an overwhelming number of Black residents, Latinx residents, and as well as immigrant residents, if you live in one of those communities, that becomes a testing criteria.
Hmm. So learning as we're going, for sure, in all of these situations.
Yes, all of that is very true. This is very much happening in real time. This is a pandemic guided by data and also guided by history.
That's Akilah Johnson. She's narrative health reporter for ProPublica. Akilah, thank you so much for your time and your work.
Oh, thank you for having me.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.